This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ يَوْمَ تَجِدُ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ مَا عَمِلَتْ مِنْ خَيْرٍ مُحْضَرًا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: Israeli forces attack Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem al-Quds for a second consecutive night, leaving scores of them injured. Afghanistan is reeling from Saturday's bomb attack outside a school in Kabul's Shia Muslim neighborhood that left over 50 people dead. The coronavirus crisis in India shows no sign of abating as the South Asian country reports more than 400,000 cases for the fourth straight day. My name is Arash Zahidi. Welcome. Scores of Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces attacked protesters in Jerusalem al-Quds for the second night in a row. Palestinian Red Crescent says 90 people were wounded in the violence in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israeli soldiers fired rubber bullets, sound grenades, and water cannons to disperse protesters. Violence comes a day after over 200 Palestinians were injured during regime forces' attack on worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the city. Israel has tightened restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Quds since the start of the holy month of Ramadan. The regime's plan for raising homes of several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah to make way for settler units has also increased tensions. The so-called Middle East Quartet of the U.S., Russia, the EU, and the UN have expressed deep concern over the violence in Al-Quds. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have vowed to adopt retaliatory measures against the Israeli regime's latest atrocities in Jerusalem al-Quds. Ruba Shabit reports from Gaza.
The Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine held a press conference warning that Israeli regime will face retaliatory measures over its ongoing attacks in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip marked Saturday as a day of popular rage along the border fence, where the resistance announced a return of military clashes with the Israeli army and firing incendiary balloons toward Israel in response to the crimes committed in Jerusalem al-Quds.
What is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds is systematic apartheid policy that aims to demolish the Palestinian cause. The recent eviction of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah is totally refused by Palestinians. So the resistance in Gaza announces the return of clashes on the borders and calls for a new uprising if these violations continue.
In a recent speech, resistance leaders warned that Israel should bear the responsibility over the recent attacks against Palestinian residents in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds, saying the resistance is ready to defend Jerusalem with all means.
We hold the Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of the crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian resistance won't sit idle against the killing and eviction of Palestinians. Jerusalem is our red line. All Palestinian groups are united in responding to these crimes, and the response will be heavy.
Palestinians called on the international community and all Muslim nations to support Palestinians and do actions to stop the Israeli violations of Palestinians and the ongoing attacks of the holy places in Jerusalem.
Palestinians are all united in the face of these Israeli crimes. We are calling on Islamic nations to stand by Palestinians and stop these Israeli violations. Our main goal is protection of the holy city.
Palestinian worshippers clashed with the Israeli regime late Friday at Al-Aqsa Mosque in an escalation of weeks of violence in Jerusalem. Palestinian resistance here holds the Israeli regime responsible for the attacks against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds, announcing they are ready to respond. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The Israeli military has targeted a position belonging to Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in the central Gaza Strip. Our correspondent there, Ashraf Shannon, joined us earlier with the latest on the incident. Take a listen, please.
According to witnesses in the area, Israeli tanks targeted a Hamas security post east of the central Gaza Strip town of Deir el-Bala, while the Israeli regime announced that a warplane hit that same security post. It's possible that the Israeli regime used tanks and airplane to hit that security post, although no injuries were reported in the area. The Israeli regime claims the attack was a response for a rocket that was fired earlier. But during the past hours, young Palestinians were flying incendiary balloons in the east of the enclave to protest against Israeli attacks on Sheikh Jarrah and occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds, where Israeli settlers and forces have been attacking Palestinians trying to evict them from their homes.
The Yemeni army says it has carried out yet another retaliatory drone strike against Saudi targets inside the kingdom's south. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the strike successfully targeted the King Khalid Air Base in the city of Khamis Mashayt using Qasif K2 drones. The attack is in response to Saudi Arabia's years-long aggression against its southern neighbor. Riyadh and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Tens of thousands of people have been killed and millions displaced as a result of the war. But the Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have stepped up their retaliatory attacks against the kingdom in recent months. The death toll from Saturday's multiple bomb explosions outside a girls' school in the Afghan capital, Kabul, has risen to over 50. Authorities say at least 150 people were also wounded in the blast in an area largely populated by the Shia Hazara community. President Ashraf Ghani has blamed the attack on the Taliban, but the militant group denies any involvement in the latest bloodshed. Families of the victims blame the Afghan government and Western powers for failing to put an end to violence in the war-ravaged nation. The Shia Hazara community has been targeted in the past by the Daesh terrorist group. The blasts came a week after remaining U.S. forces
began withdrawing from Afghanistan. Nearly two decades of the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan has failed to quell violence and ensure security in the country. A correspondent, Amin Alami, says the multiple blasts outside a school in Kabul on Saturday were just minutes apart.
The incident happened when a heavy car bomb blast went off in front of the entrance gate of Sayyid Shahada High School that is located in western part of Kabul. According to the local sources, just a few minutes after the first blast, that was a car bomb blast, two other explosions also happened there. They say that those explosions were IEDs that were planted by terrorist groups there, but Afghanistan's Interior Ministry confirms only one explosion at the in front of Sayyid Shahada High School in western Kabul, and have not commented regarding to the rest of other explosions that happened there in Dasht-e-Barchi. This area, I mean Dasht-e-Barchi in western Kabul, particularly educational centers in this area have been repeatedly came under attack by Daesh terrorist group. In the eyes of Daesh terrorists, Shia Hazara people are not Muslims, and they must be killed.
Iran's president says almost all main sanctions on Tehran have been lifted, noting that talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal continue on some details. Hassan Rouhani made the remark one day after the fourth round of talks on reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action began on Friday in Vienna. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the U.S. has an obligation to help salvage the agreement which it abandoned in 2018. Zarif said Washington was the one who pulled out of the agreement and violated its commitments under Security Council Resolution 2231. He said President Joe Biden should now decide whether the U.S. continues lawlessness or adheres to the law. This comes one day after Biden raised doubts about Tehran's seriousness with regard to the revival talks. Political commentator Ramiro Funes says he's cautiously optimistic about the lifting of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Take a listen, please.
Seeing the sanctions lifted are a huge victory. However, we also have to be cautious. We have to be aware of the fact that Biden and the Obama administration, the Democrats, during Obama's presidency, they still sought for regime change in Iran. They still supported the NGOs, the color revolution style uprisings against Iran. And so on the one hand, while we have to celebrate this as a victory for the people of Iran, to be able to trade, to be able to develop and lift more people out of poverty, we also have to remain vigilant that the White House will try new maneuvers against the people of Iran to implement regime change, which is ultimately what they want. We have to remain vigilant.
India is spiraling deeper into COVID-19 crisis as deaths and infections have been hitting record peaks in the world's second most populous nation. Fresh figures indicate that the country's daily death has surged past 4,000 for the second consecutive day. No fatalities have taken the overall tally to over 240,000. Infection cases have also risen by over 400,000 to above 22 million. A sweeping coronavirus wave has spilled over into neighboring countries, affecting Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal. In Pakistan, people rushed to markets before a week-long partial lockdown. The government imposed restrictions ahead of Eid al-Fitr celebrations that mark the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. To help me give you a better picture of what is happening in India today, I'm going to bring in Munawar Zaman. He is our correspondent in the capital, New Delhi, who comes to you live via Skype. Munawar, please.
Well, as you rightly said, every day the death toll keeps mounting and mounting and mounting. I was reading some reports which contradict government data of death figures. Some reports suggest that till the date of May 5, India could have seen as many as 650,000 deaths. Because this is something which many experts are also arguing, because the real picture is not on the public domain or on the social domain. Nobody knows actually how many people are dying every day, because since the outbreak, we have seen how many people are queuing outside the crematoriums, and graveyards are also full. So there is a huge debate and there's a huge discussion going about the death toll, which many say is much higher, perhaps triple, than what the government figures suggest. Now, what the government is doing, it is considering locking down the entire country. The opposition party is pressing the government that in order to break the chain transmission, we need to have some sort of lockdown, but it should be a complete lockdown on movement of anything. That means a movement of anything except those in emergency services. And the other thing that the government is right now trying, it's trying to boost its vaccination program, which is going on in many parts of the country, but it at the same time is dealing with the shortage of vaccine supplies. Well, this is a question many are asking, because the country has a huge population and getting people vaccinated is a humongous task for this country. At the same time, the oxygen supplies to some extent have been restored since last 2 days. The oxygen supplies are now trickling down to some hospitals. The burdens on the hospitals have lowered to some extent because they are getting appropriate oxygen supplies now. Yesterday, the government has also given new guidelines informing all the hospitals, directing all the hospitals to make sure that every person is admitted who has a COVID-19 without getting a COVID positive test, because there is a tremendous pressure on the laboratories, on the labs for conducting COVID tests. So that's the reason why they want to avoid this COVID testing. Rather, they have made some special arrangements. They have dedicated different wards for different people. So the government is trying hard now to deal with the situation, but it looks like it's very, very bleak situation, and it will take more time to deal with it. Back to you.
Well, sympathies for the situation that is going on in your country, Munawar Zaman. At least you can take good care of yourself and remain healthy. Thank you very much for that update, and have a good time. Leaders of the Islamic community residing in Italy have commemorated Al-Quds Day by holding a video conference on the significance of the Palestinian struggle. This comes as the indifference of international media towards the Palestinian cause grows exponentially by the day.
Muslims across Italy have virtually observed and taken part in the International Al-Quds Day on Saturday, the day after the last Friday in the holy month of Ramadan. A commemoration was held in the form of a video conference titled Jerusalem Al-Quds. The initiative was attended by authoritative figures from the Islamic community in Italy. The virtual gathering sent out a strong message of undivided solidarity with the people of Palestine in demanding self-determination, independence, and dignity.
Since 1948, the Zionist entity has embarked on a program of oppression of Palestinians, cancellation of our history, culture, art, and architecture, a program of ethnic cleansing. Jerusalem is our stronghold and the capital of Palestine. It's time for the international community to address the normalization deals signed by some Arab countries, which is an act of war against us.
Video conference speakers stressed the fact that as the occupation in Palestinian territories continues, the Israeli occupiers are annexing more areas, killing more civilians, crushing all political resistance, and shutting down free press. This comes amid the growing indifference of the international community.
The Italian media have increasingly failed to report on the Palestinian struggle over the past years. On Thursday, the Italian Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio met with his Palestinian counterpart Riyad Maliki in Rome, but the encounter went utterly unnoticed by the media.
Over the past years, we have recorded a growing lack of attention to the Palestinian struggle. There appears to be a plan to eradicate humanity from our existence. It is so much easier to control people with no humanity, and the COVID crisis has made this process much smoother.
Al-Quds Day was first introduced by Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979 and has become an annual affirmation of the Muslims' solidarity with the people of Palestine in the struggle for the liberation of Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Max Civili, Rome.
And that's it with international news.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
the month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. One of the goals of fasting is to attain God's proximity, but this does not mean to be isolated from the society. As a matter of fact, fasting has both individual and social impacts. According to the statistics of relevant organizations, the rate of social crimes decreases notably in all Islamic countries during the blessed month of Ramadan. Thus, Ramadan makes an appropriate ground for shunning immoralities. A cursory look at Muslim societies in Ramadan shows that there is a public tendency toward doing certain acts and refraining from others. Muslims in this month are inclined more than ever to help the needy and the poor. Many of them try to solve financial problems of orphans. Indeed, fasting strengthens the sense of sympathy with those people who are in problem and need in one way or another. It makes us heedful of the deprived strata. Although, for the second consecutive year, people avoid gatherings and adhere to health protocols like social distancing, the hearts of people has come closer to each other. Everyone tries to have a share in assisting others. A fasting person who wants to travel, if he leaves his city after the azan or call for prayer of midday ritual obligatory prayer, his fast is correct. But if he leaves the city before the azan, provided that he goes as far as 22.5 kilometers away, his fast is nullified. This is called religious distance. So he should break his fast and he can compensate for this day later on. Thus, if he travels a shorter distance, his fast is correct. The distance is reckoned from the last building of the city. Well, dear listeners, we are approaching the final days of the blessed month of Ramadan. If you remember, we had said that the night of Qadr is the time of determination of all events of 1 year for every individual. It is the night when the fate of the world and human community is determined. That's why some of the great ulema used to keep vigil all of the nights of the year in order to achieve the bounties and blessings of this unmatched night. If you recall, it was said that the eve of the 27th of Ramadan is considered by some ulema, especially Sunni brothers, as the night of Qadr. Interestingly, the supplication for the 27th day of Ramadan reads, O God, grant me on this day the virtue of the night of Qadr, and turn my affairs in it from hardship to ease, and accept my excuses, and remove from me sins and loads of evil deeds, O kind to his righteous servants. Late Ayatollah Ahmad Mojtahedi Tehrani briefly explained this supplication, saying, according to the first part of this supplication, some people believe that perhaps the eve of the 27th of Ramadan is the night of Qadr. Shias believe that most probably the 23rd is the night of Qadr, while the Sunni brothers believe it is the 27th. In the second part, we ask God to change our hardships to ease, and then we go to God and apologize for what we have done. If a child apologizes before his father, the father will be kind to him. This is while God is much kinder than parents, and we surely forgive.
Thank you.
Now let us recite together the special supplication of this night. O expander of the shade, while you would fix it if you want it, and made the sun as its cause, then captured it easily. O owner of generosity and nobility and grandeur and bounties, there is no God except you, knower of the hidden and the manifest, the compassionate, the merciful. There is no God except you. O all holy, O all benign, O securer, O all conserver, O almighty, O all compeller, O all magnanimous, O God, O creator, O maker, O shaper, O God, O God, O God. The best names, the loftiest parables, and grandeur and bounties belong to you. I ask you to bless Muhammad and his progeny and place my name on this night among the successful, and my spirit with the martyrs, and my good deed at the highest point of paradise, and my evil deeds forgiven. And I plead to you to grant me certitude which accompanies with my heart and faith, which takes doubt away from me, and make me satisfied with what you have distributed for me, and give us good in the world and good in the hereafter, and guard us against the punishment of burning fire, and give me a sustenance on this night, your remembrance and your gratitude and enthusiasm toward you, and returning to you and assisting me in what you have assisted Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad. Greetings to him and them.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Palestinian cause has always been a core pillar of the Arab and Muslim homeland, the Ummah, as well as an important religious issue. Palestine's capital, Jerusalem, is home to the three major monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And of course, the Palestinian issue is also an issue of anti-imperialism. Israel was created in the wake of a mandate under the British Empire, and the Zionist ideology consists of dispossessing Palestinians of their homes and giving them to Jewish settlers from Europe and elsewhere. Let's take a look at 73 years of Israeli occupation in Palestine and international support for the Palestinian struggle. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In 1916, during World War I, the British and French empires carved up the Middle East and divided it between themselves under the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement, named after Sykes, a British diplomat, and Picot, a French diplomat. During that time, the British had used the Arab tribes to organize an Arab revolt, rising up against the Ottoman Empire and defeating them with promises of independence for the Arabs. But these promises of an Arab homeland were short-lived and instead replaced with more colonial rule once again. In 1917, the British government issued a public statement saying that it would create a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Shortly after, following the end of World War I, Palestine became a mandate under British rule from 1923 to 1948. In 1947, the United Nations came up with a partition plan which would divide Palestine in one half for the Arabs, one half for the Jews, and the Holy City of Jerusalem as a separate international entity. When the United Nations officially adopted the partition plan, 33 nations voted in favor, 13 against, and 10 abstained. The Palestinians and Arabs vehemently rejected this plan, which was seen as just another colonial partitioning, but this time for different settlers. After the British mandate was up in May 1948 and the Israelis declared their so-called independence on the last day, the other Arab countries declared war in support of Palestine, among them Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. This war resulted in a defeat for the Palestinians and Arabs and is known in Arabic as the Nakba, the catastrophe or cataclysm. Palestinians were robbed of their homeland, their independence, and their right to self-determination. This was followed by destruction of homes, villages, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Millions of Palestinians were forced to flee in a mass exodus, seeking refuge in neighboring countries like Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. Millions more were displaced and scattered internally inside Palestine, becoming refugees and stateless on their own land. And to this day, Palestine is not recognized as a state by the United Nations, despite the fact that Israel is, even though Israel is sitting on Palestinian land, occupying the Palestinian people and made up of settlers who come from around the world and are not indigenous to Palestine. 1948 was not the only attempt by the Arabs to liberate Palestine. They tried many more times throughout the 20th century, again in 1967, 1973, and have supported the various Palestinian resistance and liberation groups throughout the years. Although there have been several wars and attempts to liberate Palestine, Arab support for the Palestinian cause has varied greatly through these many decades. Some consider the Arab support to be invaluable in keeping the Palestinian cause alive and sustaining the resistance. However, others feel that Arab countries' support has not always been unwavering, and in some cases, even blunted parts of the Palestinian resistance in order to protect their own interests, which is seen as being selfish and not in the interest of Palestine. The 1950s and 1960s marked the peak of Arab nationalism. In a period of decolonization or supposed decolonization, many Arab countries sought to unite with each other, and leaders like Egyptian President Abdel Nasser were revered all across the Arab world. The idea of Arab unity or pan-Arabism even resulted in Syria and Egypt forming one country called the United Arab Republic from 1958 until 1971. Egypt even kept this name for several years, and Syria still has the same flag to this day. However, at the height of all this, the war in June of 1967 marked the first great defeat for the Arab world. The Six-Day War resulted in a crushing, resounding military defeat. In a period of just 6 days, the Arabs could do nothing to liberate Palestine and in fact lost even more territory than they had begun with. As a result, Israel captured the Golan Heights from Syria, the Sinai Peninsula and Gaza Strip from Egypt, the West Bank and Jerusalem from Jordan. It was a soul-crushing and humiliating defeat that resulted in the fracture of Arab nationalism, in Nasser's resignation, and showed that the Arabs lacked unity. If the Arabs were too divided to even defend their own land, how could they possibly free Palestine and the holy city of Jerusalem? And since then, Israel has continued to illegally occupy the vast majority of these territories in violation of international law. So far, Israel has only given back the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt, but still illegally occupies everything else. There have been multiple United Nations resolutions demanding that Israel withdraw from these lands and recognizing them as not Israeli. United Nations Security Council Resolution 242, which was passed in November of 1967, clearly it demands the withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. However, to this day, 53 years later, Israel still refuses to do so. The UN and the international community have always recognized Jerusalem as a separate territory, or corpus separatum. This is specifically outlined in UN Security Council Resolution 181, which was adopted in 1947. A further resolution, 252, which was passed in 1968, urges Israel to refrain from unifying Jerusalem, which is essentially akin to annexation. In July of 1980, Israel violated these resolutions and passed a so-called Basic Law, or Jerusalem Law, through which it illegally annexed East Jerusalem and declared the Holy City its capital. The UN Security Council passed a further two resolutions in 1980, resolutions 476 and 478, calling on Israel to desist from altering the character and the status of the Holy City through legislative and administrative measures and censoring Israel's Jerusalem law. A year later, in December 1981, Israel proceeded to illegally annex the occupied Syrian Golan Heights in violation of Resolution 242 yet again. Israel has categorically refused to abide by any of these UN Security Council resolutions. At this point, it's perhaps easier to count the number of resolutions that Israel has abided by than the ones that it hasn't. At this point, especially after the defeats of 48, 67, and 73, Arab nationalism and support for the Palestinian cause had significantly declined, and Israel now had received not just the full political backing of the West, but also its military backing through NATO, along with various forms of aid and military assistance from the United States and its allies. Throughout the years, one need only look at the map to see how much land Palestinians have lost through one form or another to Israel. And the more land the Palestinians lose, the more they are forgotten by the world and their supposed Arab brothers. Through colonization, war, and annexation, Israel has taken more and more Palestinian land, and even just last year, in the run-up to July of 2020, threatened to annex more of it, up to another 30% of the West Bank, in an annexation plan put forward by Netanyahu. This ultimately did not take place, but the Israelis definitely gained something else instead. The majority of Arab countries do not recognize Israel as a state. However, Israel has succeeded in turning some of them to its side through various measures. Egypt and Jordan were ultimately drawn into making peace and establishing ties with Israel through help, or some might say coercion, by the United States. Recently, even more Arab nations proceeded to recognize Israel and establish ties with the Zionist regime, after then U.S. President Donald Trump pushed through the Abraham Accords in 2020. With the Abraham Accords, through this agreement, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates opened embassies and economic relations with the Israelis. It had been already known for a few years that some of these Arab kingdoms had ties with the Israelis, but now this was finally out in the open and their cards on the table. There are still other Arab countries who are suspected of engaging with the Israelis, such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar, although they have yet to openly normalize relations with the Zionist regime, but it's rumored they will in the near future. Since Israel is a settler colonialist project, it deeply wants to be recognized as a real country. This is something that the Israelis crave very much. Perhaps one of the only valuable cards that Arab countries still hold is their refusal to recognize Israel. This is the only political leverage that they have, since virtually none exists militarily or economically. More importantly, perhaps, it is a moral imperative not to do this. How can these Arab countries recognize an Israeli state on Palestinian land when the Palestinians do not even have a state on Palestinian land? This is not only leverage, this is not only about leverage, but about common sense and solidarity. And nevertheless, when Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan recognized Israel, they threw away that leverage. When Iran had its Islamic Revolution in 1979, this was not just a rejection of imperialism, beginning with the ouster of the Shah, a puppet installed by Britain and the United States for access to Iran's oil, but also the beginning of a new source of support for the Palestinian resistance. Where the Arabs had failed, perhaps Iran had stepped in. One of the core pillars of Iran's Islamic Revolution has been the liberation of Palestine. Under the Shah, Iran had established ties with the Zionist occupation because the Shah was doing the bidding of the West. However, in 1979, Iran severed ties with the Israelis and handed over Israel's embassy in Tehran to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. Every year since, Iran celebrates Quds Day, or Jerusalem Day, as a show of solidarity with Palestinians and for the liberation of the holy city of Jerusalem. This is not just celebrated in Iran, but also internationally with various marches of solidarity in other countries and cities across the world. Israel has, of course, dubbed the celebration anti-Semitic, which is what it says about any criticism of Israel. And now the holiday has actually even been banned in Germany. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Dr. Daniel Yegich, writer and researcher based in Lebanon. Thank you for taking the time, Daniel. It is great to have you on the program.
Thank you.
So, Daniel, I want to go back a bit in time, you know, in terms of Arab support for the Palestinian cause. You know, we start in 1948 with Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan, Egypt. They all marched to war in the name of Palestine. But, you know, ever since, among each one of them, their support varies and changes over the years. And I was wondering if you can maybe break down why this happened and why you had a kind of split in factions and in terms of, you know, support from the Arab countries towards the Palestinian cause.
That's a very important question. And yeah, as we can see today, if we start looking at the situation from today's perspective, several Arab countries have officially announced the normalization with the Zionist regime. And of course, this is a result of decades of an increased cooperation between several Arab regimes and the Zionist entity. And of course, it has to do with Israel throughout the last 23 years becoming quite a strong player in this region, obviously through it being supported by the United States and numerous most Western countries. To an extent that allowed Israel to expand its expansionist and settler colonialist hegemony that it has in the region. And of course, numerous Arab countries, particularly those that have quite recently announced their normalization with Israel, are as well regimes that are not necessarily democratic countries, but unelected dictatorships that work in accordance with the United States and its allies, which makes them natural allies of the Zionist entity as well. And then at the same time, of course, within the so-called Arab world, several countries have never had any conflict with Israel, whereas others, such as, beyond Palestine, of course, Lebanon and Syria, are until this day affected by, to some extent, daily invasions by Israel. And look at, the situation in Lebanon, where Israel is invading the Lebanese airspace several times a day. So there have been different experiences and different orientations towards the Zionist regime that range from opposition to complete acceptance of the Zionist settler colonial project.
Was there a split in terms of support in regard to strategy? Because, some countries, perhaps Egypt, didn't want to get drawn into a war with Israel again, and so they hindered the Palestinian resistance. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, countries have been under pressure. If you look at, Egypt or Jordan, who have officially signed peace treaties, all of this was also based to some extent to keep themselves safe and secure within their own borders. And then to that extent, Palestinians have oftentimes been an obstacle for these regimes in order to enforce their own political, economic goals. And of course, I guess the United States plays a very particular role there as well, which also exerts pressure on its allies to move towards closer ties with the Zionist regime.
I recall a famous speech from the Syrian defense minister, Mustafa Atlas, where he's angry at Arafat for going to the White House, for engaging with the Israelis. And it's actually interesting because in that speech, he actually doesn't mention the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. He speaks specifically about Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. Why is that? Why does Jerusalem, Al-Quds, hold so much importance? I mean, obviously, it's a holy city, but, to all the parties who support the Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because Jerusalem think is at least symbolic or representative of this whole settler colonial inscription and indigenous erasure. This week there have been several new incidents of violence, of settler violence, of Israelis trying to expel Palestinians from their homes. So there's a constant recreation of violence on a territory that is officially occupied under international law. And of course, it has a historic significance, being the declared capital of Palestine, and plays a particular role in numerous religions, which is why I think it has symbolically, as well as politically, quite a strong importance. But it's also a declared goal. It has always been the goal of the Zionist settler movement to get to Jerusalem and to convert it into their city, or what they call as unification of Jerusalem. So that's why it is also central in ideas of decolonization and liberation of Palestine.
Yeah, you mentioned the recent violence that's taking place there in Jerusalem, these pogroms, these angry mobs chanting death to Arabs, and the Israeli border police, they're essentially just letting them do it. I mean, what is the current state of Palestinian support from their neighbors and the international community? Because as far as I can see, it's non-existent, right? And this is just happening in broad daylight, and no one says anything.
Absolutely. We're living in times of social media where, I guess, on a daily basis, there are new videos and audio, visual evidence of Israel's crimes, of Palestinians being killed live on camera, evicted from their homes. And the international community has remained either silent to some extent, but at the same time has also, throughout the last decade, reframed the Palestinian cause from a struggle, a colonized people's struggle for liberation, into a sort of diplomatic conflict between two equal sides. This is something, I guess, that we also see in the media coverage, also of the latest events in Jerusalem, where oftentimes situation is presented as an alleged fight between Jews and Arabs, between Palestinians and Israelis, and so on. Whereas effectively, it is, of course, a very genocidal settler colonial movement, and language plays a very particular role in that. And we see that even, as you mentioned, the Arab regimes that have normalized their ties with Israel as well aren't paying as much attention to that as they might have done decades ago. But the violence has become quite normalized. And even though there are numerous new eruptions of violence, as they have been referred to in the media recently, they are part and parcel of a structure, because Zionism as a settler colonial movement is genocidal in its structure and continues to kill Palestinians and to destroy Palestine, whereas, again, the international community isn't really intervening, but rather choosing euphemisms and synonyms for ways in which they can maybe reduce, at least linguistically, these genocidal dimensions of Israel's violence.
I want to talk a little bit about Quds Day, or Jerusalem Day. You know, this is something that has been celebrated by Iran to show solidarity with Palestine since their Islamic Revolution. And I wanted to ask if you can maybe expand on that, and also how Iran, you know, being the only non-Arab country in the region, how it's still been a huge supporter of Palestine in general from, 1979 all the way until now.
Yeah, Iran has shown, continues to show strong support for the Palestinian resistance, both, of course, through solidarity, ideology, as well as, I guess, economically and financially. And there, it is Iran's support for the Palestinian cause has also been an issue for several Arab regimes that have maybe gained more of a distance towards the Palestinian cause as such, but is also used by the Zionist regime in their propaganda, pretty much as in, there's this continuous repetition of Orientalist tropes that the Zionist regime has employed, and whereas it was previously the PLO, in particular, or Hamas, it is today oftentimes Iran that is a direct target of the Zionist regime, being accused of anything that has to do with Palestinian resistance efforts. So to that extent, Iran, of course, is a non-Arab country, plays a major role in the continuity of Palestinian resistance efforts and efforts of liberation against the Zionist regime.
Would you say this support that comes from Iran, Syria, Lebanon, the support they give to Palestine, that it's actually one of the main reasons the West targets them for regime change?
Yeah, so of course there is solidarity among the population in these countries, but also beyond in the broader region with Palestine. At the same time, of course, Lebanon and Syria and Iran themselves are targeted by the Zionist regime because Israel's violence has never been restricted to historical Palestine. I think this plays a major role and makes a difference between these countries and other countries in the region that may have more of a normalized or stance towards Israel or not a conflict at all. And of course, at the same time, they are, as you mentioned, victims of sanctions or warfare or both by the United States. It also puts them in a role of a struggle that, again, connects them to the Palestinian struggle, I guess.
So just to wrap up, you know, I don't know if you heard about this, but just as Iran has its Quds Day, the Israelis have something with a similar name. They celebrate Jerusalem Day. And I don't know if you've heard of that, but, you know, the Israelis, they call the Iranian Quds Day celebration anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic. Well, they equate the two. And, you know, the Israelis, they celebrate Jerusalem Day. They are celebrating the capture of Jerusalem in 1967, which, I mean, in of itself is an act of war. It's a violation of international law. It's ethnic cleansing. I mean, did you know about that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, it makes perfect sense because this whole Zionist narrative is really just based on myths and ways to construct the history and the connection to the land that was not there before the settler colonial movement. And I mean, as far as I know, the celebrations of that day have been banned in some parts of Europe because they're deemed, I mean, at least in Germany, I think, those are deemed anti-Semitic and so on, in line, of course, with this very Zionist and actually anti-Semitic narrative that equates Israel with Judaism. But yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that the Zionist regime is having their own day because it's also a way for them to inscribe themselves into Palestine and to construct the connection to the land that wasn't there before.
More than 70 years of occupation, war, bulldozing of homes, ethnic cleansing. Israel can only be built at the expense of Palestinians and always has been. Don't take my word for it. Take the Israelis.
We take house after house. All this area will be a Jewish neighborhood. We are not finished the job. We are going to the next neighborhood, and after that we will go more. Our dream that all East Jerusalem will be like West Jerusalem, Jewish capital of Israel. אני רואה בזה המשך של המפעל היהודי-ציוני, המשך שיבת ציון. זה הכל, זה בא על חשבון הערבים. כן, גם בג"ץ והכנסת בנויים על חשבון ערבים, וגם המדינה כאן הוקמה, כן, על חשבון חלק מהתושבים הערבים שגרו פה. וזהו.
The Palestinian issue is really not a complex issue. It's very simple. All these educational videos, reports, documentaries, and people who rewrite and whitewash history, they want to frame it as a war. It's not a war. It's an occupation. It is a settler colonialist project born out of the ashes of the British Empire. The only difference between the right-wing Israelis and regular Israelis is their methodology, but the result is still the same.
שישרף לכם הכפר, מוות לערבים, זה מייצג אותו?
אולי לא בדרך ובצורה הזאת, אבל אני...
איזו דרך עד?
אני מדברת יפה. אני לא אומרת שישרף לכם הכפר, אני אומרת שאתם תעזבו את הכפר ואז נגור בו. זה בדיוק כמו שאנחנו עושים בעיר העתיקה, אגב.
Ethnic cleansing is a crime against humanity, and in order to justify its occupation, Israel seeks to criminalize any criticism of Israel by shutting down even the mildest criticism. The Zionist occupation defines the boundaries within which any speech about it is permissible. Israel uses its lobbying power in the United States and Europe to ensure that politically and culturally, people are not allowed to criticize it. Although the majority of Arab people support the Palestinian cause, unfortunately, it seems there are not many governments left who do. Who besides perhaps Syria, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and Algeria? It seems that some Arab governments have forgotten their brothers in Palestine and the holy city of Jerusalem, which is at least what they signal when they accept this occupation and establish ties with it. Nevertheless, despite the varying degrees of support from Arab countries throughout the years and the international community's inability or unwillingness to hold Israel accountable, this doesn't change what Zionism fundamentally is. It is a racist, settler, colonialist ideology that treats Palestinians as third-rate citizens and uproots them from their homes. It is incumbent upon every human being with a conscience to oppose Zionism on moral and ethical grounds and to see the situation for what it is. It's an occupation. The Palestinian struggle is a struggle for human rights. It is a struggle against imperialism, against colonialism, and against oppression. Everyone, all across the world, should support the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
In Britain's long tradition of honoring a family which are the beneficiaries of a system which caused the death of millions in the name and cause of the empire, we now learn that Boris Johnson's government is set to purchase a yacht to honor Prince Philip, officially, of course, to carry out royal duties. I prepare for you an article written by Richard Sedan, a journalist, writer and television reporter. The piece is titled, £200 million for a yacht to honor Prince Philip. Britain has far more important priorities. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sedan's article. According to reports and news that the British government is planning an expenditure of £200 million of British taxpayer money to build a yacht to honour the late Prince Philip, while perhaps unsurprising, is still nonetheless shocking. While some people in Britain revere the royal family and mark the death of Prince Philip along with pro-royal outlets with a sombre tone,